Tonight we talk about self-empowerment with a person who, like me, doesn't believe in coincidences. In a moment, Dr. Wayne Dyer joins us with his latest work, I Can See Clearly Now, next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. And as you know, we have a variety of programs for you on the show, where the paranormal, the unusual, the government corruption, you name it, we've got it. And we also do a lot on self-empowerment. Dr. Wayne Dyer, of course, one of the most widely known and respected people in this field, affectionately called the father of motivation by so many people. And despite his childhood, he spent in orphanages and foster homes, he was able to pull himself out and has overcome many obstacles to make those dreams of his come true. He spends a lot of time showing others how to do the same. His latest work, which we'll talk about tonight, I Can See Clearly Now. Always a pleasure, Wayne, having you on the program, my friend. How are you?
I'm great, George. How are you?
Good. You just keep going. Your energy level has got to be one of the highest of anybody I've ever talked to.
The interesting thing is I write by hand. So I don't use machines.
That's right.
And I don't have anybody out there writing it for me like a lot of people do.
I know. You write it all by hand, and then they scribe it for you and type it. But my gosh, yeah. How do you do it?
Well, it's just, you know, it's just like a calling. I mean, I say on June the 26th, 2012, I had made a decision to my family and everybody else that I wasn't going to write any more books. It was just too much pressure to put on me. You know, you have to face all those blank pages and it all has to come out of your head. And I said, I'm just tired of that. I've written 40 books and, you know, I'm just going to move on to some other things. And the next morning, the 27th of June, I got up and I started writing this book, I Can See Clearly Now. And I wrote every day for like 90 straight days, morning, noon, night. I was doing 3 and 4 sessions a day. My children were all here. I was on Maui. They were all here, and I just didn't even get a chance to spend that much time with them. I was just so motivated to do this entire thing. So
good for you.
It's that, you know, I don't know if I've told you before, but I was being interviewed by the New York Times so many years ago, 10 years ago or so, and I was also in the same place with Arthur Miller, you know, the great playwright.
Yeah.
And they asked him, are you working? He was 91 years old. And they asked him, are you working on another play? And I've never forgotten his answer. He said, I don't know. He said, but I probably am. And I really identified with that there's something. After I had made the decision not to write another book, I wrote this one, which is a pretty hefty book. And then I'm working on another one already. It's just one of those things that, one of the things I talk about actually in here is that there's something called horizontal time or cause and effect time. This does this and this causes that and so on. And then there's this eternal time thing, which is where everything is happening at once. And you sort of recognize that there's something else moving the checkers around in your life and is there to guide you if you're willing to listen to it. And it's sort of been guiding my life since I was a little boy.
Good for you. Let's talk about that for a moment, then we'll get into I Can See Clearly Now a little bit later in the show. But, you know, when you were a little boy, you spent a lot of time in orphanages and foster homes. I mean, it must have been rough for you. It had to have been.
You know, it just, I look back, I mean, I was in one place over on East Grand Boulevard in Detroit. You're from Detroit, too, aren't you?
I'm from Detroit, born and raised.
Yeah,
absolutely.
You went to Wayne State also, didn't we?
The University of Detroit.
U of D, that's right, yeah. Where Spencer Hayward, who lived in my home, went to.
He was in my broadcasting class.
Is that right?
Yeah, he used to sit right behind me, Wayne, and he'd put his feet up on the desk, and I'm telling you, they were like 2 feet tall, and I could never see behind him.
Well, he lived with me, and in fact, my daughter is here with me, my oldest daughter, who's 46 years old, and he used to carry her around in the palm of his hand. She could just sit right on his hand. He was so big. That's amazing.
Great basketball player.
Yeah, he was. In fact, he's up for the Hall of Fame. He was one of the winners of the Olympics in 1968 in Mexico City.
Yeah,
They allowed pros to go there.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I look back on it. There was one place over on East Grand Boulevard that I lived when I was about 4 years old that I have some pretty bad memories of. But most of the time, I've often said that you don't wake up every day and say, "Oh my God, I'm an orphan again today. How could this happen? This isn't right." You just deal with what you have to deal with every day, and then you get back, you get to be 40 years old, and you look back, and people ask you, why isn't your life working, or why are you unhappy, or why are you depressed, or why are you an alcoholic, or why? And you say, well, what do you expect from me? You know, I was an orphan, and you've got all of these excuses that you can go back and look for. But while I was going through it, I honestly can't say that it was that difficult or that much of a struggle. I loved it every day. I had a brother with me who was older than I am, but he was much smaller. He was quite sickly. And I really felt a responsibility to take care of him and to keep him from being bullied and so on. And I don't remember thinking that it was a terrible experience. I always looked sort of on the positive side of that and everything in my life.
Well, and you sure did a marvelous job pulling yourself to where you are today, Wayne.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it.
And do you believe almost everyone can do the same?
I do. I think if anyone can do it, we can all do it, because we all come from the same place, and we all return to the same place. So that, you know, everything, quantum physics is teaching us today that, you know, particles don't create particles, that everything comes from something called invisible, called energy of some kind. You know, in the New Testament, Jesus refers to it as the spirit. It's the spirit that gives life, and the flesh counts for nothing. And we all come from this spirit. We all come from this invisible place. And, I think that, you know, do you remember a book of Buckminster Fuller?
Geodesic dome inventor.
Yeah, did you ever have him on your show?
No, I never did.
He's a great man. And I got to know him just briefly. I was at a lecture of his, and we were on a panel together at one time out in Colorado. And I remember him saying, he said, you know, everyone is born a genius. But then he said, what happens is that life de-geniuses us.
That's true.
Starts to convince us that we're average or that we're not extraordinary or that we can't do things. And we start buying into that kind of a mindset. And I just never bought into that. I guess I didn't have any parents around there to tell me what I could or couldn't do. And, I really very, very strongly believe that. It's one of the places where I sort of departed with my mentor, Abraham Maslow, who really believed that self-actualization and higher consciousness were just the purview of just a small group of very select people. And I've always kind of disagreed. That's the only thing I disagreed with him about. I just felt that if it's in every one of us to be wise and to be intelligent and to be geniuses, we just have to discover it for ourselves. Because, you know, if there is intelligence behind life, and there's every reason to believe that there is, including the greatest scientific minds alive, like Max Planck and Albert Einstein and so on, that there is a matrix behind all matter, there's an intelligence behind all life, then all of that intelligence must be inherent in each of its creations, each of the creations of that intelligence, which means that all we have to do is discover it for ourselves, this intelligence, this creative source. Whatever you want to call it, I don't like to use religious terms, but whether you call it God or the Tao or spirit or divine mind or energy, whatever you want to call it, it's invisible, it's formless, and all things emanate from it. And so all the things that do emanate from it have the same intelligence in it as our creative source. That's just how I look at life.
Wayne, for you, was there that one moment, that one episode that you can look back to today and say, that's how it started to change for me?
Yeah, I can, and I write about it, and I can see clearly. The most significant moment of my life, and there were many, when I was a young boy and so on, and I wrote about when my brother almost drowned and so on at the beginning of the book. But I think the signature moment in my life was in 1974. I was 34 years old, and it was at it was in Biloxi, Mississippi, and I was at my father's grave. My father had walked out on my mother with three boys under the age of four. And just abandoned us and spent some time in prison and never paid a penny in child support and just walked away from his responsibilities. I was born in 1940, and my brothers were born in 38 and 36, so there was a depression on and a war was getting started, and it was a really tough time, and he just walked away from it. And I hated this man. I grew up having just very bitter, angry feelings towards him my entire life. And in 1974, I went to his. I found out that he had died 10 years before, and I didn't even know that. I had searched for him for my entire life, and I finally gave up when I was in my 20s. And then I went to his grave, and I actually went there to do something on his grave, you know, that wasn't to forgive him.
Oh, really? Not you. You wouldn't do that, would you?
I was full of rage. I really was. I used to dream about this guy every night, and I'd wake up in a cold sweat and just angry and just bitter. And I went to his grave, and I talked to him. He was actually born in a field. He was buried in a field for indigents. He died in New Orleans, and they shipped his body to Biloxi, and he was just buried in this place in back of a hotel. And after I left, I was there for about 2 hours, and I was all by myself. And I went back to my car. I'd rented a car, and I was going to go back up to New York. I was teaching at a university in New York, St. John's University in Queens. And something called me back from the car. And I got out of the car, went back to his grave, and then something just overwhelmed me. I've never forgotten it. And I said to him, from this moment on, I send you love. Who am I to be judging you for anything that you did or didn't do? You did what you knew how to do, given the conditions of your life. I said, from now on, when I leave here, I'm going to just send you love from now on. And George, my entire life turned around with that act of forgiveness. It was like I went back to New York. Then I gathered up all the notes I had been thinking about. I wanted to write a book about self-development and self-empowerment and so on. And I flew down to Fort Lauderdale, Florida, checked into the Spindrift Motel on A1A between Oakland Park and Sunrise. And I wrote a book called Your Erroneous Zones in 14 days. And wrote it cover to cover,
and it became
the largest selling book of the 1970s and one of the biggest books of all time. And and everything in my life changed after that. You know, that I was overweight at that time, I was drinking, I was playing around with drugs, I was in a bad way, my writing wasn't going well, I was not healthy at all, eating terrible, and so on.
Yeah. You weren't happy, were you?
No, I wasn't. And everything shifted. Everything turned around. And it was that act of forgiveness. I've always loved that quote. I've used it many times of Mark Twain. He said, forgiveness is the fragrance that the violet sheds on the heel that has crushed it. And I really understand that. And I tell everyone in my audience and all that, if you've got rage or anger or bitterness towards anyone, if you can find a place to replace it with love instead of hatred, it'll turn everything around in your life. At least it did for me.
I had Wayne Richard Bach on, the author of Jonathan Livingston Seagull, a few weeks ago. And, you know, like you, I mean, just very inspirational. I mean, it's amazing how many people are out there that truly change the lives of other people. Like
yeah,
you do.
He's one that he, you know, I have to say he's one that changed mine. I mean, Jonathan Livingston Seagull and some of his great writings. One is another one, and I have great respect for him. He was out in Washington. And
when you talk about self empowerment, the ability, of course, to just pull oneself up from the bootstraps, tell me a little bit more about what you mean. What's inside Wayne Dyer's head when he says self-empowerment?
Well, I don't know if it's inside my head, but I know that it's an energy that you can connect to at any time. And it's basically, it just comes from the old notion of as a man thinketh, that you become what you think about all day long. Do you remember Earl Nightingale?
Sure do.
Earl Nightingale? Yeah, he was a dear friend of mine and founder of Nightingale Conan out in Chicago. Produces a lot of self-empowerment tapes and so on.
Yep.
And he produced the first million seller cassette tape. It was called The Stranger's Secret. Great guy. This is Earl Nightingale. He had that real deep voice. And The Stranger's Secret, he said, was that most people don't understand, is that we become what we think about all day long. And whatever thoughts that we have, they come from, you know, they have a counterpart in our body. So that if you're thinking that you can do something, then you're much more likely to be able to put it into practice. You know, William Blake once said that everything that now exists was once imagined. It had to be first imagined. So that the corollary of that is, if you really want something to exist that doesn't exist, you must be able to imagine it. You've got to be able to expect something of yourself that perhaps nobody else has ever expected of you, or maybe the whole world says can't be done, and so on. But and if you have that, if you have that the greatest gift that you've ever been given is the gift of your imagination. And you can place anything in there, and anything that you place in there, if you hang on to it and live from a very firm conviction that you're going to attract it into your life, I believe that the universe begins to conspire with you. And the forces of, you know, whatever you want to call them, higher consciousness or whatever, work in alignment with yourself to be able to manifest anything that you place your attention on. And I just absolutely believe that, you know, and I've lived it my entire life.
Right now, Wayne, there are so many people who I believe are unhappy, bitter. I've never seen anything like it before, and I'm not alone here. A lot of people have seen this themselves. Just a lot of unhappy human beings out there. What's going on with them, and how do you pull them back?
I don't know, because I don't talk, honestly, I don't think like that. I don't really see that. I guess you have to, and you're, you know, in the business that you're in,
yeah,
the work, kind of work that you do, you're sort of reporting on it. And
I'm in the middle of it all.
Yeah, right. But I just think that people don't understand their magnificence. They don't really realize, you know, who they are and what they are. You know, my teacher, I had a great teacher in India. His name was Nisargadatta Maharaj. And when we asked him the question, what is real? His answer was something that I've never forgotten. He said, that is real, which never changes. So anything that is constantly in a state of change, you know, which includes your own body and everything in this physical or corporeal world that we live in, is in a constant state of change. But who we are is that invisibleness within this body, and that invisibleness, that intelligence, whatever you want to call it, is basically who you are. You know, if you think that you're the body that you live in, and, you know, I have a picture on the wall that I just looked at about 20 minutes ago of me when I was running when I was 21 years old, and I can't find one cell left of that body. You know, when I was in that body at the age of 21, I absolutely believed that that's who I was. That I, you know, just like I'm 73 now, and I look at this body I'm in, I think, well, this is me. You know, but an hour later, you look at it, and it's something different, because as soon as you get a hold of it, if it's constantly changing, it's an illusion. It isn't real. But the me that's inside of this body and that has been occupying this body for all these years is something very, very different. You know, Emily Dickinson, the great American poet from Amherst, Massachusetts, she had a wonderful little poem. She said, holding up a handful of dust, she said, this quiet dust was gentlemen and ladies and lads and girls, was laughter and ability and sighing and frocks and curls. You know, it's like, and I know the rest of that poem, but I don't want to take the time. But what we have come to believe is that who we are is this, you know, this body that we occupy and all of its limitations and the stuff that we have and our accomplishments and so on. But if people really understood that who they are pieces of God, pieces of the divine, that they must be like what they came from, and we all come from the same intelligence, you know. If they really and truly knew that, you know, I love the poets, as you can tell. And
yeah.
T.S. Eliot once said that we shall not cease from exploration, but at the end of all of our exploring will be to return to the place from which we originated and to know it for the first time. And I think he was speaking about death, and I'm not. I think you can come to know this intelligence that you came from, and to realize that you're an absolute miracle, you know, in a timeless, spaceless universe. It's like, you know, you start thinking about some of the stuff that you talk about on your shows about aliens and about this universe and how big it is and how infinite it is. I'm reading a book now called Our Mathematical Universe. Great book. I don't know if you've had him on your show. Hegland, his name is. And basically, the science now today has really absolutely concluded that the universe is endless. You know, that there's no end to it, so that, you know, there's no beginning to it and no end to it. It's infinite. A true sense of infinity has been proven. It's like, you can't even get, you know, grasp a concept like that, you know, that this thing just goes forever. And you're a part of that, so that who you are is not this changing phenomenon of this body that you're in, but the infiniteness of yourself, your soul, and that's going to go on forever. When you get that and you grasp that and realize that, you start living from a place.
It's truly amazing. Hey, Wayne, stay with us. We're going to come back in a moment. Well, with Dr. Wayne Dyer, we're going to come back and talk more about his work. I can see clearly now that's his 41st book. Just amazing. Hey, by the way, television show Beyond Belief. Have you had a chance to watch it yet? You can. Great guest. 10 days free. I really like the program. I hope you do, too. Go to this website, beyondbelief.com. Simple as that. Beyondbelief.com. And welcome back to Coast, Dr. Wayne Dyer with us. Wayne, I'm getting flooded with emails already. People are jumping for joy that you're on.
Oh, that's great.
One woman told me, and I promised her I will ask you her questions about death and your fear of death and your thoughts about that a little bit later on. But she said that she was in her kitchen and she heard your voice on the show and she went, "Oh my God, it's him!" And went running to it. I don't get that kind of response, but you do. So good for you. Let me, you know, of course, you know really well, John of God, the miracle man from Brazil, as they call him. And you had an experience with him, didn't you? Tell us about it.
I've had two major experiences. I was diagnosed with leukemia in 2011, CLL, chronic lymphocytic leukemia, which is a chronic disease. It's not life-threatening, but it can turn into that. And it's got a word, that word leukemia itself has got a lot of fear around it. I wrote about this in an earlier book, but I had a friend who's a medical doctor. She's an eye surgeon. Her name is Raina Piskova out in California. And she was going down to John of God, and she had heard about the leukemia thing that I had. And when I got the diagnosis, I must admit that a lot of the symptoms that they said that I would experience, I began to experience. Fatigue, bruising. I had to cut weight back on doing yoga and exercising and things like that, and I just started buying into that. And she went down to Abadania to Brazil, and she had a pictures of me, and they did what they call a remote healing. And this is like, there's a lot of skepticism around all of this kind of thing, because there's just a lot of people around the world, especially a lot of people out in the Philippines and so on, who've been exposed as phonies, who are just plying on people and so on. There's a lot of that. But John of God's been doing this for something like 40 years, and he has never charged anybody anything. And he's just a being that these entities just come in and do surgery through him every Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. From this place in southern Brazil called Abadania. And I've always operated from the philosophy of a great 10th century Sufi. His name was Talopa. He said, "Have a mind that's open to everything and attached to nothing." And so I've always had an open mind about all kinds of things. In fact, in writing this latest book, I've really expressed a lot of that. Just having a mind that will be open to all kinds of new possibilities. So I went along with it. I had the pictures taken. I did all of the things that you're supposed to do. I drank the blessed water. I took the herbs. I did all of this, and it was my mother's 95th birthday. That's what I can remember so well. She's now passed on, but it was April the 21st, and it was 2011, and I, 2011, and I was told by the people down there that they would do the remote surgery. Now remember, he was in Brazil on a 6-hour time difference, and I was in Maui. And I went to bed that night and was told that I was going to have this surgery. And I was told by Raina, who's a medical doctor and an eye surgeon, she said, "Wayne," she said, "you have to," she called me in the morning, she said, "you've had the surgery." She said, "You've got to treat this as if you've had your appendix removed or your spleen removed or something." She said, "It's very serious." And I said, "But I don't feel anything." She said, "Well, you have to go right back to bed for 24 hours. And then the next week, you have to really, really take it easy. You can't do any exercise. You can't do anything because you've had this kind of surgery." And so I just hung up the phone and I said, "Well, I'm going for a walk," because I go for a walk every morning, and then I'm going to go for a swim. And I got about 100 yards from where I live and I collapsed. And my kids had to help me get up. They brought me back up into my home. And I slept for the next 24 hours. I didn't get up at all. Just was conked out. And for an entire week, I was just so exhausted. I can't even begin to tell you how tired I was. I live right on the ocean, and I looked at the ocean. I thought I'd like to just go over there and see if I could just jump in and just swim. And it seemed like I don't think I could walk that far. And it's only about maybe 500 yards. I was that weak. And then a week later, they have what they call the removal of the sutures. And of course, with leukemia, there's no sutures. Obviously, it's a blood cancer. So they take an awful lot of sutures, I guess.
it would
get everywhere in your blood. But that's what they call it anyway. So it's a week later, And I was again told to go to bed, wear everything, wear white, have this blessed water next to you, take the herbs that you're supposed to do, and whatever's going to happen. And she had warned me about all kinds of things happening when they have the removal of the suture night. She said, if you have anything on high shelves in your bedroom, she said, make sure you put it down. She said, because the time before when she had that done, the whole room shook like it was in an earthquake.
My God.
Yeah.
Just from the energy?
Just from the energy of these entities, and these entities are formless. So the Brazil is no different than Maui, and they're timeless as well. These entities, they know who they are. These are former physicians, most of them. Some of them go back as far as the 16th century. And they've actually even had photographs of, the special photographs and seeing them. And I know there's a lot of disbelief around it and a lot of skepticism, and nobody had more of it than I did at the time. But I went along with it. I went to sleep that night. I woke up the next morning, and my watch, which was a very, very good watch, was a Panaway, it exploded during the night. I mean, it just broke, and it was one of those watches that was guaranteed to never gain or lose a second. It was like an atomic watch my kids got for me.
Yeah.
So the watch it lost 80 minutes, and it just didn't work anymore. I came out of the bedroom that morning. And two of my children were here, Serena and Sans. They're in their 20s. And they looked at me, and they said, well, your eye, it looks like your right eye is all it's all scratched. Is this somebody had just gone in there and taken a knife or something and scratched it. It was just bright red. And my son said to me, have you been doing drugs in there? He said, Dad, you don't even have any pupils at all. And I just came out of that room, and I don't remember anything other than I've never seen my children look so beautiful to me. The ocean looked like just a big bowl of love soup. I mean, what I think had happened during that night is that they had taken the fear out of me, because in the Course in Miracles they say that everything boils down to two emotions. It's either fear or love.
Right.
And everything that is fear cannot be love, and everything that is love cannot be fear. And you can just divide everything into one of those two categories. And when you get the word leukemia and cancer, and you're telling that your life is in jeopardy and so on, there's certainly a certain amount of a fear attached to it. It's not so much a fear of death. It's just that the word cancer and having it in your body is just loaded with that. We hear so much about it. At any rate, the fear was just simply gone. My life totally turned around. Within 10 days, I was in San Francisco. I was doing a film there called My Greatest Teacher, which is a film about finding my father on my father's grave that I talked about earlier.
Yeah.
And it was May 10th. It was my 71st birthday, so it was 2011. And I got up that morning, and I went down to the St. Francis Hotel. I took a couple of $1,000 that I had. I had a check there, and I got $2,000 in $50 bills. And all I wanted to do that day was to go out into Union Square, right outside the hotel. Mm-hmm. And I spent the entire day just talking to homeless people and putting my arms around, people that really smelled bad and hadn't had baths for a long time. And I began to talk to them and find out something about them. And I would put money into their hands. Some of them I'd put a few $100, some I'd just put a $50 bill. I did this all day long. And it was almost like a weepy day. It was the most amazing birthday that I'd ever had in my life. And it was just like all I wanted to do was just be in a place of divine love. And I think more than anything, I think that's what happened with me with the experience with John of Gaon. Everything in my life changed from then. I started thinking more about something called divine love, which is a different kind of love than human love. It's a love that doesn't change and it doesn't vary. And I have just been more a being of love and kindness and gratitude. And it's affected me in a thousand ways.
It was like a cleansing for you, wasn't it?
It really was, yeah. And it was basically just removal of the word fear or the concept of fear and just replacing it with whatever's left over when fear is gone, which is the state of divine love, the state from which we originated, the state to which we return. And it's I've written about it. I've done seminars on it. I wrote a big part of that, and I can see clearly now. It's like how it has impacted me. And my children will all tell you that, and I've become much, much more generous. I've given almost all of the money that I've made away to all different kinds of causes. I do a whole lot of pro bono kind of work and things, and I find myself detaching from. I feel like for the first time in my life, I really understand what it means to be in this world, but to not be of this world.
Yeah.
I just don't feel like I'm of this world anymore, and it's like I feel like I'm a being of love, and by doing that, I really believe that I can impact and change lots and lots of people.
What did you think of death when you were literally knocking on death's door?
I've never had a fear of that at all. I have a dear friend. Her name is Anita Moorjani. I don't know if you've read her book. It's called Dying to Be Me.
No.
She was just an amazing. You got to read this book, George. It's a page turner. And she was, and I've gotten to know her very, very well. I wrote the foreword to her book. She had end-stage cancer, lymphoma. She was down to like 82 pounds, and she only had hours, if not maybe even minutes, to live. And she had this amazing experience, in a near-death experience, where she came into contact with this consciousness I'm speaking about, where she realized that everything, there really is no such thing as time, and everything really is happening at once. And if you begin to understand what I said earlier about our mathematical universe, that this is a universe that is endless, that there's something within each and every one of us that is finite, and there's something which is the opposite of finite, which is infinite. And that which is infinite is that which never begins and never ends. And that's our soul, that's the spirit, that's the invisibleness, that's what's coming out of me right now and saying these words. It's like we can find the command center in my brain that allows me to have these thoughts and to wiggle my finger and so on. But no one has ever been able to discover the commander in the command center, the commander that is commanding these words to come out and so on. That's our soul, that's that invisibleness, and it doesn't begin anywhere, it doesn't end anywhere, because it has no form, it has no limits to it. And that's who I've come to know, that who I am. And when my mom passed away on July 22nd 2 years ago, we used to talk about death all the time, her and I. And she, I just really feel that she's in such a blessed place that I'm almost a little bit envious of it, and know that it's just, there's something very exciting. But my teacher, Abraham Maslow, who wrote all about, and you know, the whole idea of self-actualization and so on, he said the flaws of self-actualized people, and I've tried to be one in my lifetime, he said the flaws of them is that they get over death almost as if it didn't happen. Because for them, it's not any kind of a tragedy. It's just something, it's an awareness that I can now finally, I can shed this body. I was just with, you know who Ram Dass is? I'm sure
yes.
You must know about Ram Dass. He had his 80th birthday just about a year or so ago, and I was there at his birthday party. And we all had to say just a few words as we went around the table. There was wavy gravy and, you know, some of the people that... Timothy Leary's son. You remember Timothy Leary?
Oh,
so,
yeah.
He was very close with Ram Dass. So I was the first one to speak. And I quoted, a very famous Irish poet, William Butler Yeats, when I said, to Ram Dass, I said, you know, this is what Yeats said. He said, an aged man is but a paltry thing, a tattered coat upon a stick, unless soul claps its hands and sings, and louder sings, for every tatter in its mortal dress. We're just tattered coats on a stick. What a great image, poetic image that is. We're just tattered coats on a stick unless we find our soul. When you find your soul, you can't kill that which is deathless. You can't kill that which has no form to it, which has no beginning, which has no end. And that's how I feel about death, and I've always felt about it. And I'm actually envious of my mom. And I came full right into, you know, real first-hand contact with it, with my meeting with Anita Moorjani and what she experienced and when she came back and what she had to teach us. She'd be a great guest on your show.
Yeah, we got to work.
Terrific, terrific person.
That would be something. So, you know, we're in no rush to get to the other side. We'll all get there eventually anyway.
Yeah.
Did you ever have, even when you had turned the corner, did you ever have any doubts? Did they crop up at all?
Doubts about?
About just, you know, the self-empowerment, about, you know, striving to change.
No, George, I
you never looked back, did you?
No, it's like, you know, Maslow used to tell us, you know, self-actualizing people are people who have banished all doubt. You know, they just, they come from a place of knowing. And it's almost like you can almost see into the future with that kind of an awareness. You know, there's different ways to reach enlightenment. You know, one of the ways to reach a state of enlightenment is through suffering. It's a very, very ineffective way to do it, but you can have a bad experience of some kind or another, you know, a breakup, you know, an accident, an illness, any number of things. And then time goes by and you look back on it, like I look back on the days that when I drank alcohol and did drugs and so on, and I don't look at them as... you know, as some terrible things. I begin to realize what a great gift they were. Even my father walking out on us, what an incredible gift that was for me. It really taught me about forgiveness and brought me to a whole new place in my life. So that, you know, as you have these experiences, you look back on them and you say, okay, so 10 years later, now I know why I did it. But you don't get too many 10-year periods. So it's not a real efficient way to run your life, because you get three or four of those and then you're out of here. So the second way to reach enlightenment is through enlightenment, through being in the moment, so that when anything is going on in your life, like a tough something that's happening to you, you know, you're going through a divorce, you're going through a sickness, whatever it might be, and instead of saying, okay, 10 years from now, I'll know why I had to go through this, you begin to say, what's in this for me right now? What's the lesson in this? And what am I going to gain out of this? And let me be in a state of gratitude for it, because it's probably going to give me the energy to propel myself to a higher place, because almost all spiritual advances are preceded by a fall of some kind or another, and they help us to generate the energy to get to a higher place. So that's like the second way. But the third way to reach enlightenment is what I call, you know, enlightenment by avoiding it and getting out of the way of it and anticipating it, so that when you start seeing things coming at you before they even get there, before these negative things show up in your life, before these debilitating experiences. And I always say, in a marriage or in a relationship, you can understand this. You can be in a relationship with someone, and instantaneously you can say, okay, this is what she just said, and she's obviously wrong. But if I point out that she's wrong, then what's going to happen? And then we're not going to talk, and then we're going to have a freeze out, and we're going to have 3 days, there's going to be no sex, and all kinds of things are going to happen. And all of this can take place in 1 second. And instead of letting yourself get into that place where you're going to have that really, unpleasantness in your life, you just say, you know, honey, that's a really good point, and you just let it go. And you can do that not just in your relationships, but you can do that in everything in your life. You can anticipate things coming before they even get there, because you're not living in chronological time. You're living in what I call eternal time, and I can see clearly now an awareness I have the possibility within me to avoid all of these kinds of things. I think we can do this with illness. I think we can do this with accidents. I think we can do it with virtually anything in our life. We can get out in front of it, and before it even shows up in our life, we can make it go away.
What would have happened to Wayne Dyer had he not changed, had he not turned this life around?
Yeah, I'd probably be still bagging groceries at Kroger's on the east side of Detroit at Outer Drive and 7 Mile Road.
I was doing that too.
Yeah, and that's
it was peaceful. Right? You know, life was a little more peaceful than those.
You know,
days.
And it wasn't bad. I mean, I used to work two cashiers. I used to call myself a double bagger. Everybody else, I think I can take two cashiers at once, and bag here and bag there. It was always kind of fun for me.
Now in Los Angeles, they charge for the bags. Can you believe
it? Yeah, they do here too in Maui. Yeah.
I asked the store guy, I said, so why are you folks doing that? He said, we're not doing that. This goes to the city. They make all the money. It's all about money, Wayne, with these people.
Yeah, but there's also out there on these oceans. I live on the ocean, George, and and I swim every day. I was just out there swimming just a few hours ago with the humpback whales. I mean, there's like whale soup in front of my house out here. There's so many of them out there. And, you know, there's 1,000 mile, that's like across the entire state of Texas, floating debris of plastic bags.
I want to talk with you about some of that. Wayne, we're going to come back and really get into I Can See Clearly Now in a moment.